Our topic for this next discussion is going to center around a word that'll be new to most of you. That word is conformity. Conformity. And it's one that you may not have heard before. Even though you may never have used the word, you're going to become very familiar with its meaning before too long. Because the word conformity has a whole lot to do with teenagers and those during the adolescent period of life. The word conformity means the tremendous need and desire to be just like everyone else, to do what they do and to say what they say and to think what they think, and to be afraid to stand alone on any subject, to feel this great pressure to be like everyone else, to conform. That means to take on the shape, not just the physical shape, but the mental shape, the ideas, the fashion, the way of walking, the way of talking that everyone else is saying is right for that time. And there's tremendous pressure in our society on all of us to conform, to try to be like other people. Now, let me give you an excellent example of conformity to try to explain what I mean. And this example took place in a group of adults. You see, it's not just teenagers that feel this need to be like everyone else and to make sure that everybody approves of them. Adults feel it, too. And I gave this example in a speech that I was giving a while back, and I have taken the recorded session and asked the people who are making this tape to record here my explanation of that event. So coming up next on the tape is an explanation of conformity and how it applied in one particular situation. A few years ago, when I first went to Children's Hospital in Los Angeles, it was 1966, when I joined the staff there, and I had to go through an orientation session. Now, this is something that everybody has to go through when you take a new position. It's not something that you look forward to. It's something that you have to endure. And they're always dull. They're planned to be dull. The personnel has some requirements on the people that they hire to run orientation sessions. First of all, you must have a monotone voice. Ruled out completely if you don't. If you have a sense of humor, you're crossed off immediately. Those sessions are just always dull. They talk about Blue Cross, and they talk about retirement, and they talk about the telephone, and a lot of things that you're bored with until it's too late. And so it's just something that you have to put up with, 2 hours long, and I knew that it was going to be dull. So I came into this room at 9 o'clock in the morning, and they brought us in, and they put us around a big horseshoe table. Now, I'm not counting those X's, but there were 12 people there that day. I counted them. And it just happened that I was the only man there. The other 11 were women. And it looked like that they were young. It looked like most of them were perhaps secretaries applying for their first job. I don't know. But, you know, the atmosphere that morning was icy. Everybody came in knowing it was going to be dull. Everybody came in as a stranger. Most of the girls, it looked like, came in with their first job, scared half to death. And so you came in just without looking at anybody else and sat down, and if you had anything to say, you kind of leaned over and covered your mouth so nobody would hear. You've been in that kind of atmosphere. And there was only one thing that was going to keep us all alive for the next 2 hours, and that was a cup of coffee. Only hope. And sure enough, over in the corner, they had a large coffee pot set up. Now, I don't know what happened. I can't explain it. I don't know why they didn't offer us a cup of coffee, but they didn't mention it. I suppose the lady didn't get in there in time to start it. I don't know, but they didn't say a word about it. And I knew those women were thinking about that coffee pot because it would chug and they'd all turn around and look at it. What's more, there were donuts all around the base. And the aroma just came out and filled the room. But nobody said anything about it. And so finally, the lady came in that was going to direct this thing. And she stood up here at the front. And she started out in a dry, monotonous voice. And she went on and on and on. And I knew those women were thinking about that coffee back there. And nothing was said about it. Finally, after an interminable period of time, seemed like it must have been an hour, she says, okay, now we're going to take a break and go get some coffee. But she organized, folks. She was organized. She just didn't turn that whole mob loose to go over there and get the coffee all at one time. I was sitting over here,
Oh, good thing. And she turns to this girl right over here. And she says, how would you like to slip back and get a cup of coffee? Well, there are a lot of ways you can get hurt doing anything in front of 11 other people. She could trip going back there. Spigot could stick on the coffee pot. She could burn herself coming back, you know. So she looked like she's about 17, 18, and she looked around, and she saw that she was in a bit of danger, and she wasn't about to take that risk. And so she kind of dropped her eyes, and she said, no, thank you, I don't believe I'll have any. Well, I knew she wanted a cup of coffee. What she planned to do, you see, was wait until everybody else went over to have coffee, and she'd change her mind. She'd go get a cup with no risk. See, so her ego wouldn't be in danger. So I knew what she wanted. I just watched her. And now the lady says, well, okay, then how about you? Turns to the second girl in the line. How would you like to have a cup of coffee? Well, this second one, you see, had all of the same risks that the first one had, plus one. The group had spoken through that first individual and said, we're not drinking coffee today. And the pressure was too great on the second one, and she says, no, thank you. Now the pressure begins to build and grow. You've got to vote a 2-0. Number 3, will you have a cup of coffee? No, thank you. Number 4, no, thank you. No, thank you, no, thank you, no, thank you. Came all the way around to me, not a soul that had a cup of coffee. When it came to me, I said, I believe I'll have a cup. I got up to go get a cup of coffee, and 11 women followed me over. We are so terrified of each other that we will not even go get a cup of coffee if it's not socially acceptable at that given moment.
Isn't it amazing how frightened we are of each other? We're terrified of each other. We're so afraid somebody's going to laugh at us or ridicule us or that we're not going to be exactly what they think we should be. And even a completely neutral event, something that has no meaning at all, going and getting a cup of coffee, is a frightening thing if we think the rest of the group doesn't want us to do it. And so we guide our behavior. We do only what we think is completely safe and totally beyond ridicule, that there's no chance of anybody laughing at us. This pressure is so strong in some people that they feel uncomfortable if they're different in anything. If flared pants are out for boys, woe unto the fellow who doesn't get the message and he wears the wrong kind of pants. Wouldn't that be awful? If a girl walks funny or she talks a little bit funny, she may be laughed at all day long. If everybody is buying Fords and Chevrolets, you better not get a Plymouth because you're out of step. You see, in any little deviation, any change from what the group says, this is what we do, becomes a breach of etiquette. It's something for them to laugh at you about. They point at you. They talk to each other about you. And it's the strongest during adolescence. This need to be like everybody else occurs most strongly during the years from 12 to 20. And since it hurts to be laughed at, most teenagers try to be exactly like each other. Let me give you an example of that. As a way of studying how this pressure works and how it influences us, a team of doctors decided to run a little experiment where they invited 10 young people, 10 teenagers, into a room, and they told them that they were going to study what's called perception. They were going to study how well these teenagers could see the board or the front of the room from where they sat. They were all very close to the front of the room. It was a small room, and everybody could see. They were not really studying how well these young people could see at all. They were really studying this matter of the pressure of the group. And then they said, what we're going to do is hold up some cards. Now, we have a whole stack of cards, about a 3-inch stack of cards here, and on each card, you'll find three lines. lines A, line B, and line C going across. And there are three different links. In some cases, line A will be the longest. In other cases, line B will be the longest. And in other cases, line C will be the longest. And they're all mixed up. And what we're going to do is hold up these cards with A, B, C on them. And then we'll point to line A, line B, line C. And when we point to the longest line on that card, please raise your hand to show that you know that it's the longest line. They made the directions very clear so that everybody understood. Line A, line B, line C, point for to the raise your hand when we point to the longest line. All right. So they raise the first card and point to the first line. Now, what one student does not know is that the other nine were brought in early and told to vote for the second longest line. They were told to put up their hands when the people at the front of the room pointed not to the longest line, but to the second longest line. They were told to vote wrongly. All right, so they hold up the first card, point to the first line, line A. In this case, line B was the longest line. Line A was clearly shorter. But when they pointed to line A, nine people suddenly held up their hand. And the fellow on whom the joke was being played looks around, and he can't believe it. He can see that line B is the longest line, but everybody else thinks line A is the longest. And he apparently feels, I'm about to be laughed at. I wasn't listening during the directions. Somehow I missed the point, and I better do what everybody else is doing, or everybody's going to laugh at me. So he gradually slips his hand up in the air with the rest of the group. Okay, the researchers who are running this study then explain the directions to him again. Vote for the longest line. Raise your hand when the longest line is pointed to. Okay, it couldn't be more clear. They raise the second card. Nine people vote for the wrong line. And the fellow sits and looks again, and he's really getting tense about this whole thing. And he'll slip his hand up with the group. And about 75% of the young people, three-fourths of them, will sit there time after time after time and say that a short line is longer than a long line simply because they don't have the courage to say, the group is wrong here. I don't know. I can't explain it, but you guys are all confused. Very few people, only 25 out of 100, have the courage to take their stand against the group, even when the group is obviously wrong. You see the pressure there of the individual, on the individual? It was very interesting also in this study that if one other student, just one other student, would vote for what was right, if he would put his hand up to the in response to the longest line, then the chances were greatly improved that the one fellow who was being studied would also do what he knew was right. You see, if you can have just one friend who will stand with you against the group, you have a lot more courage. But when you're all by yourself, it's pretty difficult to take your stand against the group because of this tremendous pressure. Now, that raises a question. Why is this pressure so great? Why do we feel so strongly that we have to be accepted by the group? Why do we have to say what they say and be exactly what we're told to be? Can't we be independent? Can't we have the security during adolescence to take our stand against the group? Well, the reason that we don't do very well with that goes back to the subject that I mentioned on the first tape. It has to do with inferiority. See, when you feel ridiculous, when you feel inferior, when you feel unnecessary, when you feel that you're really kind of odd anyway, when you don't like yourself, when you're bitterly disappointed with who you are and what you are, then you're under greater pressure to avoid ridicule from the group. You don't want anybody laughing at you, and it's bad enough the way it is without doing anything else to have them laugh at you. So you dress the way they tell you to dress, and you talk the way they tell you to talk. And all of your ideas are the group's ideas, and you're afraid to do anything. Get a cup of coffee, or raise your hand at what you know is right in the classroom, or express any of your real ideas. All you want to do is get on that chalk line and do exactly what you're told to do and fit right into the group. And it really shows a great lack of courage, growing out of inferiority. It's fear is what it is. Dean Martin said, "Show me a man that doesn't know the meaning of the word fear, and I'll show you a dummy that gets beat up a lot." And I'm sure that's probably true, but in this case, you see, it's not really fear of getting beat up. It's not fear that the group is going to hurt you. It's fear of being laughed at, fear that the group will think you're odd or you're different. And then there's this great pressure that's there. And boy, the pressure is great. There's no doubt about it. Have you ever looked at a teenage choir when they sing? Probably at your church or your school, you've seen a high school choir or a teenage choir singing songs. If you look at the girls that are there, every one of them will have exactly the same hairstyle. Every one of them. If it's in style to have your hair natural and straight, then every single one of them will have her hair down to her shoulders and straight, with very few exceptions. Very few will have the courage to curl it. If the style is curly and ratted, back-combed, or whatever the style is, they all look exactly the same. Everybody works hard to try to be just like everybody else with this pressure. About a year ago, there was a teenage choir down in Miami that was singing. And they were singing the Battle Hymn of the Republic. Now, I don't know if you know that song, but that's a very emotional song. And you can get very carried away while you're singing, "Glory, glory, hallelujah, His truth is marching on." And there were about 60 people in this choir. They were all teenagers. And as they were singing, one little girl down on the front row got so excited about "Glory, glory, hallelujah" that she passed out. Boom, fell right on the floor. And the director just went on directing, and some people came and tried to help her while they were singing, but they didn't want to interrupt the song, so they went ahead with it. And on it went. Well, you see, when that one young person passed out, all the other teenagers who were there had the idea of passing out planted in their heads. So the possibility of passing out became a thought that was injected into their heads. And it wasn't but about 30 seconds later till someone else back on the back row turned white and buckled and disappeared behind the choir. Well, then you had two people doing it, you see, and the idea became stronger. The idea of conformity fitted in. This is kind of the thing to do. It's sort of neat to pass out. Or maybe I'm going to pass out. And sure enough, number three sailed off the end of the choir. And then it began to spread, and there was, boom, number four off one side, and boom, number five fell on his face on the other side, and boom, number six. And it began to spread and grow through that choir. And I got to tell you all that by the time they got down to the very last, "His truth is marching on," 20 kids lay flat on their backs looking at the ceiling. And that, friends and neighbors, is conformity at its best. That is group pressure. That's doing what everybody else is doing. It gets downright ridiculous at times, but that's what conformity is all about. It's the pressure of the group on the individual to do what the group says is right, and the lack of courage on the individual to take his stand. We as adults are told by advertising on television and every place else that we all have to be exactly the same. You know, we're told, for example, that the wet head is dead. And what does that mean? That means that nobody uses hair oil anymore. And that means that if you use hair oil as you did 10 years ago, then there's something wrong with you. You see? Or old people are made to feel uncomfortable because they're aging. There are 3 billion people on this earth, and every single one of us is growing older. There's not a single one who isn't. There's only one alternative to aging that I know of, and that's death. And that's not exactly acceptable. And yet we're all made to feel guilty if we're aging as adults. This is a great pressure that's on all of us to try to make us into the same little cubes, the same little blocks, so that we all look exactly alike, and nobody has the courage to be independent and to take their stand. Now, so what? Why is what I've been talking about important to you, and why will you need to know something about conformity as you go into the adolescent years? Can you see any reason why conformity could be dangerous to you? Can you see any reasons why it could get you into trouble and difficulty a little bit later on? If you're in a group right now, I would suggest that you turn this tape off and discuss this matter of conformity. How does it hurt you? How does it keep you from doing what is right? How can it interfere with your life? If you are with your mother or father at this time, turn off the tape and discuss that before we explain it further. Or if you want to keep it running, I'll just talk to you about it. The reason conformity is so dangerous is that it can make you do things that you know are wrong simply because you do not have the courage to tell the group that you won't do that, that you can't be different. You see, suppose that you're in a car with a group of your friends. You're 15-year-old and all the rest of you are 15. And you're driving around at night and somebody has some pills, some drugs that they get out. Now, drugs, as you may know, are being used by teenagers every day throughout this country, and they're destroying their bodies, completely destroying themselves. They'll never get over it. The human body is very delicate. You can kill it without even trying, or you can damage it so much that your rest of your life is spent in pain, or it doesn't function like it should. And drugs and pills and different kinds of shots that you give to yourself damage the body permanently, which is an awful thing to do to yourself, much less when you're young and you have your whole life ahead. Most teenagers know this, but it's the conformity that gets them into trouble. So they're in this car and they're driving around and somebody breaks out some reds or some yellows or some of the other kinds of drugs and say, let's have fun tonight. Let's all get high. And they start passing them around. And the fellow next to you has taken one and put it in his mouth and swallowed it, and he hands it to you. All right, there you sit. There are five of you in the car. The pills are in his hand, and he is reaching out to you. And what are you going to do? Are you going to be a square? Are you going to be a chicken? Are you going to say, no, I can't do that. My mommy wouldn't want me to. Or are you going to crumble? Even though you know this is damaging, even though you know it's dangerous, even though you know it's wrong, are you going to reach out and say, I'm a big shot too, and I'm grown up too, and I can do it too, and you take one and put it in your mouth? And then you see you begin to get hooked on it. And the next time it's a little bit easier to take drugs because you've done it before. And from there you start getting a habit. And then you can't get rid of the habit. I talked to a girl the other day who's 13 years old who takes 10 to 20 reds a day, all day, every day. She takes these things. And her body is so racked and so ruined from this process that's taken place that she will never be the same again. And yet she didn't have the courage the first time to say to the group, I'm not about to do that. That's stupid. That's ridiculous. Why should I do that? Why should I ruin my body? You see, conformity takes its toll, and this pressure builds, and you're sitting there in the car, and your mind is whirling, and you're trying to think of an excuse for why not, and you can't think of one, and so you go along with the group, and then you're trapped just like they are. What you don't know is that they're under the same pressure you are, and they're taking it for the same reason that you took it, because they're frightened to say no. They're afraid they'll be laughed at. They're afraid that the next time the driver of the car is going around to pick up his friends, he won't pick you up because you're not, a lot of fun to be with. So there's this great pressure that gets us into so much trouble. How much better it is to sit there with confidence, to show that you have confidence in yourself, and you say, if you guys want to do that, you go ahead. But I think it's stupid, and I think you're stupid for doing it, and I'm not about to. You see, this is not being a baby. This is not saying my mommy won't like me. This is a way of showing that you have courage to take your stand against the group. And I'll tell you something else about this. The group appreciates the guy who has the courage to take his stand. He becomes a leader. He becomes the one that they follow then, because he showed that he's not so inferior as they feel, and that he's not made out of clay or jelly inside. He's got the guts to stand up for what he knows is right. Do you feel this pressure to conform at this time? Have any of you already felt it? Let me tell you another aspect of it that you're going to find, I think. One of the greatest desires of the teenage years is to grow up. It's a tremendous desire that you develop during this time to show that you're not a baby anymore. You see, you don't want to be a little child all your life. And it's during this time that you have this desire to become independent on your own and to not be the little one at home that you've been in the past. So it's very common for you to not want to be seen with your mother and your dad during this time. Now, this doesn't mean that you don't love them anymore. It doesn't have anything to do with love. It doesn't mean that that they are suddenly not good enough to be with you. But when you're seen, we'll say on a Friday night, which is a kind of a traditional date night. It's a night when boys and girls get together. When you're seen with them, with your mother and father, it kind of makes you feel like that you're still a baby. And the others are out with their friends, and you're still with mommy and daddy. And there's kind of an embarrassment that comes along with it. And I think it's important for you and for your mother and dad to realize during this time that you're not really rejecting them or deciding that you don't love them. It's just this thing of growing up that you're going through. When I was in the ninth grade, my mother knew that I was playing games in school. As a ninth grader, I decided that it was more fun to kid and laugh and joke and give the teacher a hard time than it was to study. And I had a couple of teachers that didn't know how to control the class very well, and it was very easy to give them fits. And so I participated in this along with some of my friends. And I was having a good time, and I was laughing, and I was joking, and I wasn't making near as good of grades as I could have been, and I knew all that. I knew it wasn't right, but I was having a good time. Well, my mother somehow knew that. I don't know how she knew it. I don't know how she figured it out, but she always seemed to know what I was thinking because she understood kids so well. And she knew that I was fooling around in school, and she sat me down one day, and we had a little chat. And she said something like this to me, as best I can recall. I know what you're doing in school, and I know that you could be doing a lot better, and I know that you're playing little games there. And I've thought it all over, and I've decided that I'm not going to do anything about it. Now, I could punish you. I could take away privileges, and I could go up to the school and everything. But I'm not going to do that. I've decided I'm going to stay out of it. But I just want you to know something. If the school ever calls me, then the next day, the very next day, I am going to go to school with you, and I am going to sit by you in all your classes, and I'm going to hold your hand when we walk down the hall, and I'm going to be 2 feet behind you when all of your friends walk up. And I'm going to have my arm draped around your neck, and I'm going to spend an entire day at school with you, walking and talking with you. And believe you me, friends, that scared me to death. I had much rather my mother would have beat me than I would she would go to school with me. And that straightened me out very quickly. You can bet one thing, that I didn't want my mama following me around at school. That would have been social suicide. Those kids would have laughed at me the rest of the year if I'd have done that. And I'm sure my teachers wondered why I straightened up so quickly during the latter part of my 14th year there at school, because I just suddenly quit messing around. I just didn't want my mom coming to school with me. When I graduated from the eighth grade, my mother and my dad came to graduation. Eighth grade, so I must have been about 14 years of age. And my dad brought his 8mm movie camera, the kind that your parents probably have too. And he was taking my picture out there with my friends in front of the school. And I remember that day, I resented my dad being out there. I resented him taking my picture. And he had that camera pointed toward me, and I was so embarrassed and humiliated because my daddy was out there taking my picture. You see, that is the kind of thing that happens when you're a little kid. When you're having your fourth birthday, daddy takes your picture. And I wanted to be an adult. I didn't want to be a little kid anymore. And it made me feel foolish for my dad to be taking my picture. And we have today that film that was taken in my eighth grade graduation. And you can see this strange look on my face, this look of embarrassment as my dad took my picture. You see, these are some of the feelings you're likely to have too. Now, maybe not. Not everybody is exactly the same. That's the fantastic thing about being a human being, is that we all differ somewhat. And you may never experience that particular feeling. But it's likely that you will. And if you do, if you get the feeling that it's embarrassing to have your folks around, it's not because you don't love them, and I don't think you should feel guilty about that. It's because you want to grow up, and the pressure of the group is on you, and you're afraid you're going to be laughed at and ridiculed, and so you try to avoid that in every way that you can. This pressure to be like everyone else and to conform to the group affects us in so many ways, and I've seen some very extreme examples of it. There was a high school girl in the school where I used to work who was blind. And this young lady could not accept the fact that she was blind. You see, one of the problems with conformity is that it makes the person who can't be like other people feel very ridiculous and unacceptable. And those that don't have the money to dress like other people, or those who aren't built like other people, those who are short and want to be tall can't conform with those who are taller, or those who are too tall and want to be short feel it very deeply. So it takes its toll. It makes so many of us uncomfortable. This blind girl found it much more difficult to be blind because of this matter of conformity. She could not be like everyone else. But she refused to accept the fact that she was blind. Her way of dealing with it was to ignore it. And she would not accept the help of a special teacher who was hired to come there and work with her. She wouldn't even see her, wouldn't even go out to talk to her, and wouldn't do the work that the teacher gave her to do. And even when she walked, she tried to walk without the use of a white cane or any kind of aid. She put her shoulders back just as though she could see, because she wanted to be like everyone else so badly, and walked down the sidewalk of the school. And one day I saw her coming. Before I could stop her, she walked into a post because she refused to feel her way along, you see. She just could not accept the fact that she was different. I have seen deaf children, those who could hardly hear a thing. Only in the second grade, if you can believe this, a little 7-year-old boy, well, the one I'm thinking of, I've also seen it at an older age, who refused to wear hearing aid, which would have made it possible for him to listen and learn in school. He refused to hang that thing in his ear because the hearing aid made him feel different. The thing in his ear that other children didn't have in their ears made him feel foolish, and he wouldn't do it. And we had an awful time with him. How many youngsters get embarrassed over having to wear glasses because other children aren't wearing glasses? I know one little 4-year-old whose glasses disappeared. The mother was telling me about it. They couldn't believe it. They looked all over the house and couldn't find them. And the child didn't know where they were. And then finally, the little 4-year-old came and said, "Mommy, I have something to tell you." And she said, "What?" And he said, "I can find my glasses for you." They went out in the backyard and he'd buried them. He had dug a hole and buried his glasses because they made him feel different, you see. This is a pressure that we put on each other. It's conformity. It's felt all the way from about 3 years of age on through whenever you die. There's a certain amount of this pressure to conform. It causes so much trouble that's unnecessary. I think this is one reason alcohol is such a problem, is during the teenage years. Again, the friends will break out a six-pack of beer or wine or liquor, and others who don't want to drink it, who hate the taste of the stuff, feel they must in order to be part of the group. It certainly explains why cigarettes continue to be used in our society, even though it's proven medically that they destroy your body, that they shorten your life, that they contaminate your lungs, that they increase the possibility of cancer, that they cause the blood vessels of your body to do strange things, that there are many, many diseases which are made worse by cigarette smoking. It's an awful habit. It's a stinky habit. It stinks your clothes. It stinks your house. It stinks your car. Just thinking about it, I get all choked up. It costs a lot of money. It is a foolish habit to get into. And most teenagers know that. They've heard the advertisements. They've heard the statements in our society about the harm of smoking. Then why do it? Why pick up a cigarette and put it in your mouth and blow that rotten smoke into your lungs with all that it does to you? The reason is because one person has a pack in his hand and a cigarette in his mouth, and he turns to another and says, "Would you like one?" And we don't have the guts to say, "Of course not." We're afraid to. We're cowards. We're chickens because we don't have the courage to do that. You will be called a chicken if you don't go along with the group. But I have to tell you, the chicken is the one who does. He's the one that lacks the courage. It's the one that takes his stand to do what's right that I have the greatest respect for. And he's the one that's showing the greatest amount of courage. Did you know, my friends, that the Bible talks about this subject a lot? It has a lot to say about it. In fact, the Bible talks about nearly everything that's relevant to our lives. The Bible deals with today. It deals with you and what your life is all about. And it has a lot to say about conformity because God, in His wisdom, knew that this was a problem. This is something that can keep you from doing what's right. Let me read to you from Romans 12:2. Now, this is a King James version of the Bible, which is a little harder to understand, but I think you'll get the meaning. Be not conformed to this world. See the words? Be not conformed to this world. Don't let the world squeeze you into its mold. But be ye transformed. And transformed means made into something new. By the renewing of your mind, that ye may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. Now let me read the same verse from the Living Bible, Romans 12:2 again. Don't copy the behavior and the customs of this world, but be a new person, a new and different person with a freshness in all that you do and think. Then you will learn from your own experience how His ways will really satisfy you. You see, you have to decide in advance that I am not going to be told what to do by anybody. I am going to control my own behavior, my own mind, my own ways, my own customs, and I will be like the group on things that don't matter. I will wear whatever is fashionable if I can get the clothes. And I will do what the group says to do as long as it doesn't have any real importance for me. But when it comes to one of those issues, like being moral and being right and doing what God wants and learning in school and doing the things that are right for yourself, then you don't let anybody tell you what to do. You square your shoulders back and know that the pressure that you're under is the same pressure everybody else is under, and that you're not going to let it influence you, particularly when it comes to living a Christian life. It is somewhat difficult to live a Christian life, and no one should tell you differently. It takes self-discipline and self-control. The easiest thing to do is to follow the group, but that'll get you into all kinds of trouble and difficulty. And it's a much healthier and happier way of life to do what you know is right from the beginning. But in order to do that, you have to avoid a certain amount of conformity. 1 John 2:15 takes this one step further, and it says, "Love not the world, neither the things that are in the world. If any man love the world, then the love of the Father is not in him." You see, you should not love what everybody else says is important. You love the things that God has said is important. People are important. And truth is important. And honesty is important. And cleanliness is important. You love those things that God has told you are important, and not the things that the world tells you you have to do through the process of conformity. Now, maybe this is the best time to talk to you about the matter of feeling for other people, getting in their shoes and knowing what they're going through and kind of living in their world. And this is important because kids are so mean to each other. I mean, you guys are downright brutal at times, making each other suffer needlessly. I know a little girl who received a note on her desk from another girl in her class whom she had done nothing to. I know for a fact that she had not deserved the note that she got. But let me read it to you, because it shows just how mean and how brutal one child can be to another when he wants to. This note says to awful Janet, "You are the stinkest girl in the world. I hope you die, but of course, I suppose that's impossible. I've got some ideals. 1, play in the road. 2, cut your throat. 3, drink poison. 4, get drunk. 5, knife yourself. Please do some of this, you big fat girl. We all hate you. I'm praying, oh Lord, please let Janet die. We're in need of fresh air. Did you hear me, Lord? 'Cause if you didn't, we'll all die here with her. See, Janet, we're not all bad." From Wanda Jackson. Have you ever gotten a note like that? Or maybe more importantly, have you ever written one to anyone else that was like that? The thing is, you see, children are easily hurt, and the pain from this kind of note or something said that was mean and cutting in this way goes very, very deep, and it lasts for a long time, will often be remembered even into adulthood. And children will go to all lengths just to avoid being stung by each other because they're so sensitive about these kinds of criticisms. And the thing that young people are most sensitive about is their body. That's the one thing that matters most, and the one place where their feelings are most unprotected. I'm talking about you as well as other people. A school teacher came to me a few years ago because of her concern for a little fellow in her room named Jeff. Jeff was 7 years old. He was in the second grade. And his teacher was worried about the fact that Jeff always wore big, heavy, thick gloves, leather gloves, to school every day. And he was rarely ever seen without those gloves, even on the warmest days of the year. So it wasn't just to keep his hands warm. Jeff wore those gloves every single day. And his teacher, of course, would make him take them off when he came into the classroom because he couldn't even hold a pencil with those thickly padded fingers, and he sure couldn't write properly with those gloves on. But the moment Jeff was sent out to recess or to lunch, he brought out the gloves and put them back on again. And his teacher just could not understand the reason for him doing that. Why was he so in love with those gloves? They weren't pretty gloves, they weren't attractive, they weren't new, they were all beat up and scratched up. But all through the school year, he never stopped wanting to wear those gloves through even the hot months of the school year. And in talking to me about Jeff's problem, she just sort of casually mentioned to me that Jeff was the only black child in a room full of white children. And then his feelings began to make sense. You see, when Jeff wore a long sleeve shirt, and he had on pants, of course, and shoes and socks, the only part of his skin that he could see was his hands. And by wearing these big, thick, heavy gloves, he couldn't even see his black hands. And his black skin, you see, really didn't make him inferior, but to him it made him different from the other children. And he felt different and felt odd, and that bothered him, and he tried to cover it up. Point. And it's particularly true of the Christian life. I heard a story of a young man who made it through adolescence as a Christian, went off to college. He was a fellow that had a lot of courage and a lot of self-confidence. And in his first college class, as a freshman, the professor, who was a godless man, cared nothing about Christian principles. In fact, wanted to ridicule anybody who did. Asked his class, about 100 people in the class, if there was anybody there who considered himself a Christian. This young man looked around, and he was on the line. He had to either stand up for his Christianity or deny it, like Peter did when Jesus was about to be crucified. So he looked around and he said, yes, I'm a Christian. He held up his hand. This professor made him stand up in front of the group and said, I want you to know that you are foolish and ridiculous. He said, anybody that would believe that garbage is crazy. He said, I've read the Bible and it didn't say a thing to me. It just confused me. And this young man looked at him and he said, sir, the Bible is God's letter to Christians. And that's what you get for reading somebody else's mail. Which I thought was a pretty courageous answer. It's those kind of things that you wish you could think of on the spur of the moment, but you don't think of until the next day. But that young man had courage. I understand that's a true story. He had the courage to take his stand. Surprisingly, as you get out of high school and into college, if you're trying to be a Christian, there will be people who will try to make you feel foolish for it, as well as everything else you do. And I hope you will remember this conversation today when we've talked about conformity and the pressure of the group and the commandment of God Himself, who said, be not conformed.